Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Business Brew. I am your host, Bill Brewster. Hope spring break is going swimmingly for those of you that are on it. This episode features Dan Zwirn, CEO and CIO of Arena Investors. Arena has a flexible mandate. They will go anywhere in the cap structure, and I think that this is a very interesting conversation. I hope you all enjoy. I enjoyed talking to Dan very much, and am grateful that he joined the show. This episode is sponsored by Stratosphere.io. You know the drill. It's Stratosphere.io. Stratosphere is a great platform. I use it. I like to check out the segments and KPIs. I go to it for financials. You can compare companies within a sector. You can do some modeling in there. I highly recommend that you check it out. And it is free. F-R-E-E. So there is not much reason not to check it out. Should you fall in love with the product, please use the promo code BREW, B-R-E-W, for 15% off. Braden and his team have done a great job. I commend them for making a product that he wanted to see, made for himself. I think that's awesome. And I think it's worthy of checking out. I think it's a perfect match for the prosumer type investor, somebody that wants to not pay for institutional level subscriptions, but want something more than what I was aware existed before. So anyway, again, that's Stratosphere.io, Stratosphere.io. As always, none of this is investment advice. Do your own due diligence. This is for entertainment and informational purposes only. Enjoy the show.
Ladies and gentlemen, thrilled to be joined by Dan Zwirn today of Arena. What's the official firm name here? I don't want to mess it up on your behalf.
Arena Investors.
There you go. And Dan, you know, I got connected to you. Josh Clarkson and Aaron are my contacts that I've been discussing things with. And Josh sent me your letter, and it was a pleasure to read. So I'm looking forward to this. And, you know, I typically do public markets equity focused conversations, and I'm really excited to talk to you because there's so much more in the world than that. And I think you're a fantastic person to chat with. So thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Do you want to talk a little bit about what Arena does, and we'll kind of get the conversation started? And if you want to talk about your background and how you got into the private credit world, that'd be great.
Sure. Arena's job is to make, uncorrelated excess return per unit of risk in just about anything that makes sense. And so, you know, ultimately, we think of ourselves as a global investment firm that has a mandate to really focus on process-oriented risk versus kind of security selection specifically across virtually every permutation of industry, geography, and product that you can think of, and really to minimize moral hazard, the inclination of people to kind of do what serves their narrow short-term interests longer than they should, which is a cause of a lot of investment blowups and has been for, you know, a long, long time. So I wouldn't actually, you know, private credit is kind of a made up term. It's not really a thing. As they say, lending is the world's second oldest business. The notion that it's done outside of a bank doesn't make it special or unspecial, right? And it's just one way to provide capital. But capital can be provided to folks in any number of ways and is not necessarily a particular thing for it to be quote unquote credit versus equity versus lots of other things.
Is maybe a more accurate description of what you're doing is like merchant banking in a way?
Very much so. I would say we are modeled more like the traditional merchant banks of kind of many, many decades ago than a kind of conventional fund operator. When you go back to, you know, when kind of modern capital markets began, you know, in the 1600s in Amsterdam, you know, people accumulated capital. They took risk with their own money and had to be super careful. and they weren't kind of throwing darts at a board, right? And they were really creating edge and holding themselves up to a very high standard because they had incredible downside from the skin in the game they had. And so when you look at, you know, the kind of best performers over many, many centuries, whether it's the European merchant houses or the Hongs in Asia or the global grain traders, or in modern times, the kind of great capital allocators from Buffett to Henry Singleton at Teledyne to John Malone, they all kind of think about things the same way. And that way is nothing like what happens in kind of conventional fund operators.
And, you know, when I hear you say conventional fund operators, I guess what's ringing out in my head, and it may be not the right thing, but the part of Wall Street that I don't love is the limited liability company taking a bunch of risk. And if it goes well, hey, didn't that go well for the GPs or the founders? And if it doesn't go well, you know, you're kind of protected by a limited liability shell, and who really cares? We'll just start another one.
Well, it's more than that. I mean, it's ultimately, there's an argument that post the GFC, a lot of alternative assets became, you know, found themselves within the world of kind of pension-oriented drawdown style investors. And those investors had invest based on a model that was developed over several decades, kind of previous to the GFC, where they were effectively looking across a series of uncapacity constrained relative opportunities, right? So here's my private real estate equity versus my large cap value stocks, et cetera, et cetera. And there's no capacity constraint. And they're really making a relative judgment on, you know, whether they want to be exposed to one of those buckets versus the other. When it comes to more idiosyncratic investments, when it comes to alternatives, there are many, many permutations of industry, product, and geography within this stuff that don't go from kind of good to not so good. They go from really good to completely not good. And so it's very hard from a top-down kind of pension-style perspective to not put yourself in a position to be on the wrong end of moral hazard, i.e. hammers that only see nails. And so what we'll see is that there will be many unintended consequences from forcing the square peg of kind of idiosyncratic yield and alternative investing into the round hole of top-down stock-keeping units on a shelf-style allocation.
Do you mind just explaining the stock-keeping units on a shelf? I just want to make sure I understand exactly what you're saying.
Well, again, many large-scale allocators start with a view of the world. I think rates are going to be this, and I think inflation is going to be that. And so, therefore, I want to have this much exposure to value stocks or stocks versus, you know, equity versus debt, so to speak. And then within my equity, I want this geographic mix of continents. And within each continent, I want to have this mix of value versus growth versus big cap versus small cap and all these kind of top-down, you know, labels.
Basically a bunch of factor bets, and you sort of have like a top-down view, and then you're trying to put the factors in to express your view in the best risk-adjusted way in your model, yeah, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Yes.
And it strikes me through your writing, I perceive you to be a person that's looking to make sound investments that can work in any cycle with downside protection and potential upside optionality. Now, this is a nice thing to say. Anybody can say I like to do this. I think the devil's in the details, right? So before we go into that, can you spend a little bit of time on process-oriented versus security selection, just so I understand what you're talking about as how your firm goes about its business?
So, you know, as Buffett says, he doesn't like to pick winners, right? Fundamentally, the notion of professional asset management has been based on certain individuals being somehow brighter or more prescient than other individuals, right? And so I pick a security and I say it has a low PE, and I hope other people look at it like I do and realize it's much more valuable than it was when I bought it, and will take it off my hands, right? They are selectors of securities that are basing their judgments on a combination of their view of the ongoing earnings power of a given enterprise or asset, as well as the future perceptions of others to buy it from them. We don't do that. I would think about it like a casino, right? Someone walks in and they think, you know, I'm feeling lucky tonight, or I'm really good at blackjack, or I'm a card counter. You know, those are people who are security selectors that are fundamentally smarter than the, think of themselves as smarter than the other ones, and maybe smarter than the house. But the casino has the odds, right? It knows them down to the last basis point, and actually in a technologically enabled version of it actually can, you know, pre-program effectively how much they're going to win. And so we like to say we want to be the casino, not the gambler. And when you think about the examples that I gave you, in most instances, those are folks who've positioned themselves up front to be in that position versus, you know, having to rely on hope or other factors external to them to crystallize value.
So how did you go about creating a firm where you were in the position to have the house odds on your side more often?
Well, so the trade-off, given that there's no free lunch, is you got to work really hard and you got to spend a lot of time and money setting that thing up, right? And so I think to do that, I originally looked into history and thought very hard about the particular sources of edge and capability that a lot of those historically capable folks who had the house on their side put together in order to make that the case. And really what it came down to was three things that I spent a bunch of time trying to put together. The first was the ability to invest with no mandate other than to make optimized risk-adjusted returns. So that seems pretty obvious, except that virtually very little institutional capital is set up that way, right? Most institutional capital is set up in a manner such that they, each given fund is a hammer that's looking for a type of nail, right? And so the ability to say, well, I know at first blush, this mandate looks like we could willy-nilly do anything. But actually, it's risk mitigating because it means we have no incentive to do anything other than that which makes sense. And we'll immediately run from that which doesn't make sense and therefore minimize moral hazard.
I've been thinking more about the idea of a financial product versus an investment focused product, right? And maybe my head, I don't mean to be misquoting you, but my head is saying, you know, a lot of funds and firms are sort of financial products that are looking for the right person to express their view through the financial product. And what you're striving to set up is a true investment product where you're protecting capital and focused on making returns in the way that you're comfortable putting all your, or I shouldn't say all your capital, but it's, you know, you're aligned is the best way I know how to say it.
I'm aligned as it gets. And we talk about the notion of starting with what makes sense, starting with the left side of the balance sheet, and then figuring out the right side of the balance sheet as opposed to the opposite. And by the way, that could be painfully more difficult, but ultimately it's the long-term right and greedy, a long-term greedy way to, you know, set things up if you have the tolerance for it.
So when did you get the idea to go out on your own, and what's your background? What you've built is something that doesn't just come out of the sky, right? You said it takes a lot of money and a lot of hard work and a lot of time. You know, when I read your letter, I read how much work goes into flipping over these rocks. Like, that's not something that you can just like get the idea and manifest and have it happen. So like, what did building your firm look like, and why did people join you in the beginning? You know, just kind of to get a sense of like what you brought to the table, because I think of, you know, the implementation. It's impressive what you built.
Thank you. Well, let me close the loop on the other two items because they're relevant to the discussion of then setting it up and how I came to be able to do it. The other two items, in addition to the flexibility of mandate, are the ability to, quote unquote, turn over rocks, to source things on a purely proprietary basis without kind of breaking the bank, so to speak. And the third is to actually create the kind of servicing infrastructure to make all the trains run on time. And so with regard to the second one, which is that notion of a proprietary sourcing, what I found was that what I really used was the model of actually the Asian Hongs, who, if you go back to the kind of time of the Opium Wars and soon after, right, there were leading Hong Kong-based houses, basically, that dominated Asian trade. And they had individuals, for instance, when they went to Korea, who were native Koreans, who were allied with them economically, who gave them the ability to be the home team, even though they weren't Korean themselves, right? They had them in Japan, and they had them in, you know, other places. And this notion of, at the time, they referred to it as a comprador, but this notion of a variable cost-efficient, hyper-aligned partner that's there when you need them, when you're focused on a given area, was pretty good, pretty interesting. And we saw it in modern times done by a lot of the internal proprietary groups of the investment banks up till the GFC.
Okay.
And so this notion of having business units that have a domain capability and employees that have expertise that is exploitable throughout a cycle, but having highly complementary joint ventures that have very particular sourcing, analytical, or servicing capabilities to which you want variable cost efficient, hyper-aligned access as a complement of reporting into and partnering with those business units is a very interesting model, has been to us and has worked over the centuries. And so in addition to our 8 business units globally, we have between 40 and 50 of these joint ventures, which give us the ability to kind of, again, turn over an enormous number of rocks and have them turned over by people with unbelievably narrow and focused expertise who are putting up major skin in the game, right? And so are not hammers that only say nails. And so when you create that kind of confederacy or agglomeration of capabilities, all turning over rocks, suddenly you have this kind of, as we call it, a Darwinian funnel of optimized return-oriented risk. And you can see quite obviously where the good stuff is and where the bad stuff is. And that's a really key component of this. And again, speaks to the intangible value created over doing this for decades, because, you know, it takes a lot, many, many years and long relationships to know who has that particular industry product or geographic mojo and becoming partners with them.
So how do you think of yourself as like an LP in a number of SPVs? Is it more like a JV relationship that somebody finds a deal and then brings to you and you say, okay, well, you know, we have a working relationship, I have some capital, we'll partner on this? Like, how is that structured typically?
We're not anybody's LP. These are all kind of complementary relationships among folks who are working with our business units. And each business unit, we are making the decisions on what we do up front along the way. We're controlling the cash and the bank accounts. And those joint ventures are really integrated into or adjuncts to our business units. And also going to the third kind of pillar of our strategy, also reporting into our servicing operation. So servicing is a key element of this. And it'll be yet another of the long list of unintended consequences of kind of how the alternative space has developed since the GFC, which is that people have systematically underinvested in this, because who needs servicing and surveillance and workout when everything goes straight up? And so that having those three elements together, the mandate flexibility, the sourcing, and the infrastructure to kind of make all this happen, provides the edge that is demonstrated through the relative return punitive risk that we create, that we can measure based on kind of the exposure that we have in assets and basically how much we're getting paid for how little risk we're taking for how short of a period of time.
When you're talking about servicing, you know, my background is in commercial banking. So when I hear servicing, I hear like, borrowing base reports and to risk yes. ratings, capital at risk and portfolio management and stuff like that. Is that what you're referring to? I mean, not quite the same, but similar.
It starts with providing operating leverage to both our front office and back office, you know, getting the numbers, getting the covenants, making sure we're getting paid. When do we do this or that or the other? It then goes to things like workout, right? Which, you know, we operate very differently than a bank in that regard. We are not shrinking violets when it comes to making sure the agreements that we have with people are honored. And so there's a whole lot of incentives that folks have, and we're experiencing that in the market today, to not actually enforce their rights. And we're not shy about that, because these things don't age like fine wine. They get worse if you don't run at them when there's an issue. And then it also then goes to the notion of what is called nowadays operational improvement, where we have an adjunct to our servicing operation called, our servicing operations called Quester Advisors. We have a thing called Quester Strategic, where we're also then able to do things like add board members, add team members, enhance financial reporting and financial controls, IT improvements, marketing strategy, all of the necessary things that you might have to deal with if you happen to end up owning a company or an asset.
How often are you going in and implementing some of these operational improvements before there's like a potential workout issue or before you're behind an eight ball? Like, it seems to me that that would be a natural thing to add to some of the, I mean, if I was in merchant banking or something similar, I would say, hey, by the way, we've got this team that might be able to help your business, right? It's a natural potential.
Some people don't want the help.
Yeah.
So certainly as we do our diligence up front, we are highlighting issues of risk of all kinds. And on our own, at the very least, are saying, if this risk presents itself, how are we going to deal with it? Are we bringing to bear, or are we going to be able to bring to bear the necessary resources to deal with this issue when and if it comes and we have to own something?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. What are some of the incentives you mentioned we're seeing right now, the incentives not to recognize what's going on? You want to pull on that thread a little bit?
Sure. Well, people talk about this notion of amend, extend, and pretend. Unfortunately, we're in a market, again, everything's gone straight up. Not many people were that seasoned before the GFC, just because the number of years that have gone by. Investors and allocators don't take kindly to markdowns, right? And so, as Charlie Munger says, show me an incentive and I'll show you an outcome. There is a tremendous incentive along the entire chain of value from when investments are made all the way up to when they are allocated and supervised for there to be a avoidance of recognizing issues. And so in a number of instances, whether it's a bank that doesn't want to put up more capital against the loan, or a fund that's seeking to raise the new fund and doesn't want to kind of really deal with the issues that it has to, there's a lot of reasons why people don't want to recognize reality. And a lot of them are based on various regulatory regimes that are monitoring what folks do, right? So banks have to put up more capital against certain things. A lot of them are things like it in the insurance industry, where if I have a mark-to-market but not an actual crystallized or realized loss, I don't have to put it through the income statement. It's only on the balance sheet, right? So why should I sell anything, right? Well, that's going to lead me to maybe sell too late, right? Because if I never actually sell a loser, then it doesn't really hit my income statement. So I can still pretend that I'm making money. So there are a plethora of these incentives, and they've only gotten much, much greater over time. And they've been enhanced or made worse, depending on how you look at it, by the fact that in the wake of QE2 in 2012, there was so little yield in the world, right, that actually creditors had less and less ability or negotiating leverage to make these things structured in such a way that, you know, reality could even be realized or dealt with if it arose. And so you have very weak structures, very long duration, very low coupons and other forms of governance, because, you know, it's been an equity owner's world since 2008.
Yeah, it was, you know, I was at the bank until, I want to say like 2015, 2016-ish, early 2016. And it was interesting to see the definitions of EBITDA get a lot longer. I mean, I was at BMO and BMO Harris specifically, and I think they're a very good bank. So I'm not saying anything negative about them. But, you know, you've got to participate within the market that you're in. And the covenant structures got looser and looser. And, you know, that was at the senior level. I have, you know, read through grants what was going on in the private markets. And it's certainly the lack of some of the structural protections is concerning. On the other hand, you know, I read and see that, you know, corporate leverage seems, you know, I wouldn't say low, but moderate. So how do you think about that? Because what it feels like you're describing to me is we've been in a 12-year, 10-year credit cycle, and might we be on the other side? And that could have interesting implications if that is. So I'm curious just to make sure that we're on the same page and how you're thinking about that.
Yeah, look, I think we've had the implementation of QE2, whereby basically the Fed started buying fixed income securities in massive scale in order to de facto lower rates to well below zero, was potentially a reasonable thing to do in response to the 2008 crisis. In 2012, as a response to the equity markets going down, it was not a reasonable thing to do, right? It was the emptying out of the cabinet of basically tools that the Fed had to deal with in dealing with another potential 2008. And so it was really arguably terribly irresponsible, and it created basically the largest asset bubble that there's ever been. And so that doesn't just kind of go away by wishful thinking. And furthermore, at its best, it could be dealt with through kind of benign neglect, whereby you have a kind of post-90s Japan, where you kind of bear the brunt of a massive asset bubble spread out over decades. That could work up until the point where, as we did in the kind of, 2020 area, maybe a little bit before, that can work up until you actually then introduce grossly profligate fiscal policy. And when you start basically spending way, way, way more than you're earning, and you create gigantic deficits and enormous debt, it's very hard to effectively avoid inflation. And when you look over the past centuries and you look at a combination of really profligate monetary and fiscal policy blended together, you have never avoided very significant inflation. And when you have very significant inflation, you have never avoided a panic in the kind of traditional financial market sense of that term. And so is it possible that we will have a much longer, more protracted combination of high inflation and high rates than is wished for by the markets? I think it's probable. Is it possible that we will have an actual full-blown panic? It's distinctly possible because of a confluence of the not only bad monetary and fiscal policy we've had, but the reality of a large number of changes that happened in response to 08 that were long-term very, very damaging to the markets. And so I think a guy called Russell Napier was very bright in the UK, wrote a paper on this, but he likened our situation to the wake of a world war, right? So in World War II, all of the major governments of the world borrowed tremendously. They invested in capital equipment and other resources that were expended or effectively destroyed in the prosecuting of the war, and then were left with a huge debt without assets against it. And what they needed to do, as governments have through now a few thousand years, they effectively used inflation as a tool to lower what they owed, right? And they did so through a combination of high inflation and high rates that they purposely perpetuated in the kind of 15 years after World War II. I think it is highly likely that we will have to do something similar because we created the same or greater damage through this very profligate government and monetary authority behavior. And so that leads to real opportunity because capital has been grossly misallocated, and there'll be this long-term rationalization that has to happen as an arithmetic factor of the matter. And it's just the question of, how abruptly it happens, but it must happen, right? Because the arithmetic requires it.
The concerning thing about what you're describing from a risk perspective is one might argue, I think that there's some argument that valuations are like fine here. I don't think anybody's going to say that things are super cheap, but certainly things got beat up in the sell-off last year. That's sort of dependent upon the assumption that the underlying earnings stick. And if I were to put my hat on to argue the other side, I'd say, well, tax rates are pretty low. They could go higher. Interest burdens could increase. And if negative operating leverage starts going through the system, you can get yourself into a pretty ugly place, given where things are trading. What to do with that information is the hard part. I'm not really sure.
I don't know that tax rates are pretty low. I think they're pretty pretty darn high. I think they're unbelievably high.
Well, I guess at the corporate level with the Trump tax cuts and whatnot. I meant that.
Okay. Well, I think that there's a lot of business out there that effectively flows through and experiences, you know, directly the incredibly burdensome yoke of the government through ever greater taxes. I think that furthermore, we have a government that is really on a war footing with commerce. And you see that translated through what we see at the FTC and FCC and many other agencies that are really trying to hamper hamper commerce at every turn. And then furthermore, you see attempts by the U.S. government to basically organize other world governments so as to reduce competition that governments effectively engage in order to attract commerce to their various countries through, you know, basically kind of global tax law changes that are really damaging. And so, you know, they're working hard to create havoc, no question. And so I think you haven't seen the effects of earnings effects of inflation really hit yet. I think you have a great likelihood of it. I think you, again, just have a tremendous amount of leverage in the system, both in more so in private markets than public markets. I think it shows itself very suddenly, as you saw with the LDI crisis in the UK. There's a lot of places where leverage has crept in that people haven't noticed yet, right? That they only do when things kind of get ugly very suddenly. And there's a lot of reasons why the world is short a lot of puts from here.
I guess the question that I come back to is, what do you do sort of with the information? You know, you seem to, at least through your writing, it seems as though, you know, focus on downside and build in some upside optionality. But is that a function, I guess, should you see brighter horizons, would you be more inclined to be more upside focused as opposed to downside focused right now? I perceive what you're saying and what you write to be the old, when everybody else is greedy, I'm going to be fearful. And maybe I'll be more greedy when everybody else is fearful. Is that a fair characterization of what's going on?
I think the reality is you can't paint the whole world with one brush. And that's what we do, is we stratify the world into different areas where we can see disproportionate opportunity to the up or to the down, right? And so that has created what I refer to in the letter is really three buckets of opportunity. They're the kind of occasionally arising tactical opportunities. There are things where the party is over and we're kind of in mid conflagration. And then there are things that are slowly, you know, issues that are slowly metastasizing that are beginning to show themselves ever more each day. In the first bucket, to your point, how do you monetize this environment, right? So I would point to an interesting phenomenon, which is the tremendous inflow of retail money into the stock market. And so that has created an interesting world when you then compare and contrast that with the consolidation in the investment banking or securities firm universe, right? So you have, never have you had more individuals invested in more companies that have no attention from any large scale investment firm, right? So you have 10,000 small and microcap companies, the vast, vast majority of which are not the concern of any significant investment bank or commercial bank or private equity firm. So what do you do with that? What opportunities does that create? So we, as an example, we have a business around the world providing various forms of more esoteric convertible securities to those businesses, right? That you wouldn't otherwise provide were they to have a lower level of liquidity that they would if not for the presence of this massive influx of retail investors. So that's an example where it's an incredibly interesting opportunity. You know, people, as an example, ripped from the headlines, you saw the Bed Bath & Beyond situation, right? They were able to access financing to avoid bankruptcy, at least for the time being, because they still had a very significant market cap and a lot of liquidity in that stock. And that provided the basis by which people could invest on a kind of structured basis that wasn't exposing those new investors to the ultimate fundamental performance of that enterprise.
Yeah. That's an interesting case because that company has bought back so many shares as it died, and then here it is issuing shares to. They're doing their fiduciary duty to the company, but I would argue to investors, perhaps not. On the other hand, I guess if the liquidity's there, take it. I don't know how I feel about that whole thing. It doesn't make me feel good inside.
Well, is it better than zero?
Yeah, I suppose. Though it may go there anyway.
It very well may.
Yeah.
Not today.
Yeah.
They look.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So there are these tactical opportunities that arise in the markets that are very compelling. There are, in the second bucket I mentioned, things like the entire world of venture and growth was an enormous bubble that is now evolving and providing great, great opportunities for people who might, for instance, provide credit to folks who are incredibly disinclined to raise incredibly dilutive equity, right? And so there's a trade-off there with some of those enterprises that are good businesses, but where they effectively enjoyed the benefits of negative cost equity for the last 14 years. And so that, and they effectively substituted growth for profitability, and now they're starting to kind of have to think like normal businesses again. So there are real opportunities. There are great opportunities in the entire world of GPs and LPs and all of these partnerships that have been sold in this massive boom, where you have allocators who've said, well, maybe I have too much of this, or maybe I don't own what I thought I owned, or you know, maybe I'm afraid of the marks that are eventually going to come, right? And having to rebalance themselves in the wake of, you know, very difficult markets in what they view as more liquid equities and fixed income. And then you have the big long-term opportunities, which are in the corporate structured and real estate worlds, where there are effectively ecosystems of debt and equity providers there that have been mutually dependent and have levered one another to create the massive bubbles in each of those areas. And so, you know, in each of those, there's a kind of chain of value that was linked to a certain subset of market participants not really understanding the risk they were taking. And a lot of that is now starting to slowly unwind. And in fact, in January, you saw a significant uptick in bankruptcies. And we're seeing a lot more activity as people realize, you know, that these corporates weren't what they thought they were. These long-term structured finance assets weren't as compelling. The delinquencies are moving up in the underlying stratifications within the ABS. And in real estate, not only do you have all of that and that massive bubble, but the effects of the long-term effects of work from home and what that's going to mean for the world of CRE generally, that all of those chickens are just starting to really kind of come home to roost.
Yeah. On the last point, I'm going to be kind of interesting to see what tough times do to work from home. I probably should have executed this idea earlier, but I wouldn't be shocked to see office have a bump, but maybe not. That's why I didn't do it, because I haven't done the work to have an opinion, but will be interesting to watch in the future. You know, when I was reading your letter, you talk about LTVs, and the thought that I had was, okay, well, if your loan to value is only as good as the assumption of the value. Right. So what you're describing to me sounds like there's potentially risk to people's perceptions of the value in the loan to value. How do you avoid getting into that trap? And you know, how much of the LTV that you're thinking about is like theoretically enterprise value air, for lack of a better term, versus backed by hard assets?
Well, I think you want to go back to the source. Again, you know, you refer back to Ben Graham and Buffett and others, right? And the notion of a quote-unquote hard asset is not so obviously valuable, perhaps, and the notion of an enterprise is not so obviously unvaluable, or, you know, right? So what's common between those two is that they are representative of a value placed upon a series of ultimate cash flows, right? So people say, well, I'm a hard asset lender, right? So I have no problems because it's a hard asset. The hard asset is only as good as the stream of cash flows that are going to be derived from it, right? If you ask anybody with a gold what cash flows are going to get out of that gold, not a lot, right? So that's kind of a problem. And so, yes, we like hard assets for sure, but we're always looking at the stream of cash flow that will be derived from them. And the discount rate we're going to apply to that, right? Or the cap rate, if you want to look at that, right? And in a world where rates are, you know, 500 wider than they were very recently and potentially moving higher, that has implications for the required rate of return from any given asset that I must get, and therefore the multiple of that asset that I'll apply when thinking about what that V or value is. On the other side, with regard to quote-unquote enterprises, in the absence of hard assets, you know, there are enterprises that don't have hard assets but have kind of contractual obligations and effectively five forces, Michael Porter style, five forces negotiating leverage against their various counterparties that might be that much more stickier than any hard asset stream that you could look at. You know, as an example, look at an Oracle and how excruciating it is to get them out of your enterprise once they're in your enterprise.
Right? Yeah.
And so when we think about assets and companies and the Vs, we think about how likely that stream of cash flow is, how durable and what the duration of that stream of cash flow is, and the alternatives available for our capital and the discount rate at which we must discount that stream of cash flow in order to really understand what we're willing to take. And so going back to the beginning of our conversation, you talked about the notion of private credit. And I said, well, that's not really a thing, right? People kind of made that up in order to sell investment product. If you took someone who looked at streams of cash flows and tried to discount them, and you looked at the opportunities available today, you'd say, well, a good place to be is in the top of a capital structure, right? To own the kind of free optionality that comes from being senior, right? But if it were 1973 or four and the implosion of the markets had already happened and you could buy equities at a 20 or 25% unlevered free cash flow yield, you'd say, well, I don't want to be a lender then because I effectively have that benefit by owning the enterprise and I might as well get all the upside, right? So we're gonna move in and out of capital structures based on valuations that are in turn based on real assessments of actual streams of cash flow, and we're going to kind of pick our place in this in the capital structure to optimize, you know, our the market's perception of that.
Yeah, I mean that makes sense to me. It's a very interesting time because I think there's so many incentives, and you know, myself, someone included, to just want the party to continue to go on. And then I think sometimes when I say to myself, okay, let's just take a step back here and think about, if I were selling assets into this market, what's the probability that I look back and I say, boy, I really like gave something away? I think that's a pretty low probability. Might it go higher? Yeah, it may go higher. But like, I don't think this is one of those regret moments where you're selling at like a 2008 bottom. And I hope that we can all agree on that. And then, you know, I get myself thinking, well, the investment community writ large, all the incentives are to stay long. Right. And then when it doesn't work, well, we all said stay long together and just stay long because now it'll work from here. Right. Now the returns are great. The returns are never that bad forward looking. Right. It's a very interesting time to live. And I did a historical look back on CPI versus the 5 and 10 year. And right now we are not exactly synced up on where we may be headed. Right. So if inflation's not coming down, I don't think there's any law out there that says that bonds have to give real return. I think there's theoretically some version of the world where there's so much capital that you don't get a real return, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And if bonds go higher, I could see things going lower as the math may work. But I, you know, it's interesting. I've never lived through this period. Kind of feels like we're at the end of a party, potentially, and nobody wants to turn the lights out.
It does, but you know, markets can be ignorant longer than you can be solvent. And so we're never ones to bet on the timing of any of that. We're pretty darn certain of is there's going to be a lot more volatility in the world, and a lot more distortions and a lot more dispersion on a return rate of risk basis. And so we want to be a beneficiary of that, right? We're a casino and there's never been more gamblers. And so, you know, we want to wave them all into the casino, and we want, if they are feeling really upside oriented or downside oriented, we want to give them every way to play we can.
Yeah. And I think what I like about how you frame where you're positioned is, if you are senior and not afraid to enforce your rights, you can have a catalyst, right? One of the things that bothers me is people are like, well, if you're buying at a price to book, a discount, a price to book, or price to replacement value, one, we have to have a discussion of whether or not it's worth replacing. But two, if it's in a public entity and I can't affect the change, then it's not really that enticing. I mean, I kind of get over the long term, it's a weighing machine, but that sounds kind of beauty contest gambling to me.
Well, that's a killer because I have a warm spot in my heart for, you know, deep value folks, but deep value with an inability to kind of take it in your hand and crystallize it is brutal and can disappoint you for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't do things where hope is the strategy.
I guess to play devil's advocate, they might say, well, hope's not the strategy. The long term is the strategy, but I'm more in your camp. I mean, I think when I look back at some of the stuff that Buffett did, he was the guy that drew the line and said, get inventory below here, right? He was the guy that was liquidating stuff. Now, maybe he said it's not.
I think with Graham had a real focus on, here's a liquidating entity. The guy already said he's going to liquidate it, and I'm going to effectively be the beneficiary of the last puff on the cigar. I think as Buffett evolved and he started to see you know, the opportunities and things that weren't, that were sustainable, five forces, defensible franchises. And he started doing this at a time, but, you know, it really scaled at a time, basically in the wake of 1973, when it was, you know, spectacular. But he was looking at it in the way that we're talking about, which is, never mind the price, right? Am I happy to get this unlevered free cash flow yield? And so what will force the issue is the production of large amounts of free cash flow, right? Then can I then screen for stewards of that capital that are aligned with my interests? And in his case, you know, like as an example with Washington Post, he went on the board and, you know, he didn't crystallize the value, but he certainly educated Catherine Graham a lot about, you know, how to crystallize value and kept her laser focused on it. And he was a good scout of the combination of great moated franchises with great stewards of capital. And you put those two together, and that's pretty interesting. There's a lot of people who have worse businesses or are bad stewards of capital or are misaligned in their interests. And, you know, you can kind of yell and scream at them and send them all the 13 D letters you want. They're not going to do what they need to do.
Yeah, that's right. And that I was saying to Aaron before we hopped on the call, you know, I read Ben Graham and I thought I knew every answer. And then I realized I didn't even know the right questions to ask. And now I'm trying to get better at asking those questions. But I think the alignment of interests and or the ability to effectuate change is a very, very, very important part of what I look for these days. You know, let's say we do go into a default cycle. I think, you know, one of the myths, so to speak, is that, you know, defaults are bad and equate to losses. Do you mind riffing on that a little bit?
Sure. Well, I think, yeah, again, one of the other unintended consequences of kind of how the credit markets are set up is that there is this notion of what is called the, you know, basically a focus on defaults and coverage. So if you look at the way banks look at their assets, insurance companies look at their assets, agencies, rating agencies evaluate credit, they're very focused on, you know, how many times, what is the likelihood of a default on a given borrower's credit? And if there is a default, what will be the losses, right? And so if I'm hyper-focused on defaults and cash flow coverage, I can optimize for that by writing very weak lending documents. So then there's nothing to default for. And I can charge a really low level of interest that the cash flow available will more than handily cover. So there you then have systematically poorly structured and poorly priced credit. Right. And so it's a borrower's dream, by the way. I mean, and you should own assets and finance them that way when lenders are feeling like that and combined with, of course, very low rates as what happened for the last 14 years. The reality is what matters is not defaults, but severity. How much are you actually going to lose? And not coverage of interest, but leverage. Right. So I would argue that I want to have plenty of defaults because I want to write lending documents that are really tight if you say you're going to make, you know, X plus 5 and X plus 10 amount of cash flow, then, you know, within 95% of that, do it, right? Or recognize that the fundamental risk reward of what the lender has provided you is different now, and a different level of compensation is warranted because you weren't able to make those numbers, right? And so covenants, you know, should be tight, and when defaults happen, it should be known, and there shouldn't be negative consequences for that, right? Because that actually is a good thing. It means you're doing your job. You're focusing yourself and your counterparty on performing. Similarly, if I think about what is going to drive the outcome of a credit-oriented investment, the fact that it covers its interest is not that interesting to me, right? By definition, if I'm doing my job as a creditor, I actually want a coverage of interest to basically logarithmically descend toward one, right? Because if I'm doing my job, if there's a dollar of cash flow, ideally, if I'm an aggressive creditor, I would like to have as much of that dollar as possible, which will end up providing a very low coverage, right? But that's okay, because there's only so much cash flow and someone's got to have it. And if I'm providing credit, I'd rather have as much of it as possible and therefore have a low coverage.
So real quick, I don't mean to, but why are term loan Bs so prevalent if that's the case, right? You've got no prepayments, you've got nothing. Is it just for the origination fee and the ancillary banking that comes with it?
Well, there's moral hazard around the creation of fees and the fact that some other guy's taking the risk. So why not?
Yeah, you create it and then you syndicate it out, collect the fees and move on, do the next.
Or it goes into a CLO structure managed by someone that doesn't have skin in the game, with that in turn is financed by incredibly cheap financing on the debt side. And on the equity side, people who are willing to own other people's CLO equity and effectively let them make lots of money in management fees while they get, you know, they face the moral hazard of, you know, what's going to ultimately happen when they're involved in loans that are 11 times levered.
Man, I like talking to you. I like how you say what you think. It's nice to hear. It's refreshing. Well, but doesn't diversification, you know, solve all these problems? Aren't you fine if you're diversified among, you know, credit alternatives?
Well, you know, I think the notion of diversity is one that's underappreciated as well. People have made a lot of studies on, you know, how many stocks do you need in order to be appropriately diverse? And, you know, plus or minus, people talk about 30 as a particular number, but those are based on basically a normal distribution of return outcomes. You know, if you are a creditor, right, you actually don't have a normal distribution of outcomes because you have a capped upside, right? And so what you have looks less like a pool of stocks and more like a pool of insurance risks, right?
Yeah.
And so if I were an insurance company, I would never, you know, concentrate just on Japanese earthquake, right? Even though I make for 99 years, I might have a great time, but during that one year, I'm done.
Yeah.
Right?
Avoid the tail risk.
Exactly. And so I think the mathematics of that reality imply a level of diversity that is not frequently prevalent in a lot of kind of credit-oriented funds. It is in banks at many instances. But that then begs the question of, do you have the resources necessary to originate and surveil a sufficient number of risks such that you have an optimally idiosyncratic risk mitigated portfolio? And the answer is that's difficult, right? So, because it's hard to have, you know, 75 names when, you know, 15 will do, except 15 might work for a PE firm. It's not going to work for a pool of private credits where if you have one problem, you're done.
Does the 15 that works for a PE firm, we're at a part of the cycle, and I'm talking longer term here, where you're able to hit like that one big winner, right? And like venture capital has been, I don't want to say bailed out because it's by design, but they've got like these massive winners. Are we learning that lesson because of where we are in the cycle? And if you're maybe 5 years forward and equity valuations are a little more depressed, like do the same rules apply, right? Or are we learning some of the wrong lessons right now?
Well, look, I think venture capital is a unique animal. And what you're talking about is the hope, right? And the reality is that venture capitalists like to use this notion of the power law, if you're familiar with it.
Yeah.
Right? Whereby a disproportionate amount of economic activity goes to the kind of few winners. What they don't like to do is apply it to their own industry. And the reality is there's a few winners in venture capital. And because they have the best relationships and have been a beneficiary of the virtuous circle of, I did X deals, so I get the next Y deals because they're the best two and they want to associate with the guy who did the X deals, et cetera, et cetera. But the other 99% of venture capitalists, if you look at their returns over time, it's ugly. It's really ugly, right?
Yeah.
And certainly not worth the existential financial risk of that you're taking when you're investing over time in that area. And so, those very special firms in the venture world are very special, but they're special because they are the beneficiaries of a power law dynamic that has allowed them to effectively own convexity. So as we come into this very difficult market in their world, my guess is the very small number of them that are on the right side of that equation are going to say, look, this last one or two has been really rough, but we're special. And by the way, a lot of them are run by billionaires. So they're going to say, we're going to put in hundreds of millions or $1 billion into this new fund, right? And they're going to be a beneficiary of all the damage that's happening to all of the other 99% in their world.
Yeah, the strong get stronger in tough times may apply there as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, interesting. Do you mind explaining, we talked a little bit about CLOs, and I apologize for being a bit of a fifth grader on this topic. I know it's a collateralized loan obligation. I understand like what people own, but I don't fully understand why people own the equity versus why people own other parts of like a CLO. I mean, what is CLO equity and why am I buying it and what am I looking for there?
Sure. Well, I would think you worked at a bank.
Yeah.
Right. I would look at a CLO as just a kind of mini bank, right? So a bank basically has, let's say a bank puts up a dollar, an owner of a bank puts up a dollar of equity. It takes in $9 of deposits and uses that $10, right, to go make 10 loans of a dollar each. That's it. That's a bank. And the hope is that by virtue of putting up that dollar of equity, the yield on my 10 loans will be higher than the cost of the deposits I have for the $9, right, that I paired with my $1 in order to make the $10 worth of loans. And the basic construct there is that I'm the manager of the bank and it's my dollar, right? So I'm probably going to be pretty focused on making sure those 10 loans are the right loans. CLO business, slightly different. I'm going to open up a bank. I'm going to raise $9 worth of, instead of deposits, I'm going to borrow $9 in the form of bonds, right? And then I'm going to use your money as the equity. And I'm going to put in nothing. And then I'm going to make $10 worth of loans. But now I'm someone who hasn't put up the dollar that's below the deposits, or in this case, that's below the bonds, right?
Yeah.
And so I have a big call option. And it's actually really big, right? Why is it really big? Well, because I get to charge a fee on the $10 worth of loans just for showing up. I get an additional fee if it happens that the yield on those loans minus the cost of the bonds is positive, right? So I get kind of some upside. I am correlated, my outcome is correlated in that respect with the equity providers. But furthermore, if I can do 3 or 5 or 8 or 10 or 15 of those deals, my stream of income might be capitalized by 10x by someone who might buy it from me, right? So I've got a monster size call option off your back, right? And it's kind of, I've turned down the ability to do this, too many times, and it's a great business stream of income to have. If you don't mind explaining why you lost people their money.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't CLO equity okay post-2008?
Yeah, so it turned out that the loans that were on the balance sheets of CLOs in the crisis ended up making enough return, total return, such that after the payment of the interest on their bonds and the principal of their bonds, they ultimately enabled the people who provided the equity to do reasonably well, right? So they experienced mark-to-market that was, you know, sometimes down 90-plus percent, but it all came back. And unfortunately, that gave a lot of people confidence that it always works that way. And as a result, it created a tremendous bid to make a lot of these CLOs, which created a tremendous bid to be a lender in leverage finance at now the most aggressive time that it's ever been in that world. And so the fundamental quality of the loans that went into those CLOs post-GFC was much diminished relative to pre-GFC. And so that very same equity risk is a very, arguably, very different risk. Now, if people keep showing up to provide that equity, right, you'll effectively save the people who made that investment, right? Because you'll create demand for more leveraged loans. It'll create demand to refinance the people who have those loans, which will effectively save the bacon of the people who provided those that CLO equity. The reality is people are starting to realize, geez, I don't want to be the one holding the bag when this thing kind of all rolls back. And so the question is, who's going to wear it, you know, when it all breaks? And so I think what you're seeing is people's willingness to provide that misaligned capital is much lower, which then creates a whole chain of
Well, then that sort of even that behavior reduces the ability to extend and pretend, right? And then you start to actually see the losses, and then people start to actually get scared, and this is how these things happen, right?
Exactly.
Interesting.
Exactly.
Yeah, I thought this, I remember when I was a trainee, somebody came in and he was giving a presentation to our class, and the big takeaway that they had from the global financial crisis was how well auto loans performed. And I thought to myself, and this is not even revisionist history, this is real history. I thought to myself, it's going to be interesting to see how car loan terms progress going, forward. And it seems to me that they are longer than they have traditionally been, and potentially the LTVs are, you know, still in line. But I'm going to be interested to see if we have the same takeaway the next time around. I tend to think that Wall Street gets a nugget of truth and then takes it a little too far. That would be my operating premise.
Well, auto finance was looking really, really rough coming into COVID. And COVID was a massive, massive boon to auto finance. It really saved it, because suddenly you had consumers with money in their pocket from the government with ultra low rates and ultra high availability of finance. And so all of the people who had made and taken horrible, profligate auto loans coming into COVID got saved, right? And it was really manna from heaven for the both borrowers and lenders in that space. And so the bubble got, you know, blown up even bigger. And suddenly, you know, people with, it's almost like the pre-GFC mortgage loans, which, if you'll recall, the ninja loans, no income, no job. Some people with relatively modest means were, you know, get into that next $120,000 F-150.
Yeah.
Right? There's a lot of that. And when that backs up, it backs up enormously.
Something that I'm thinking as we're talking is like, but the labor market's so tight. So, you know, I mean, to the extent that some of the guys that work on, like, I'm building a house, and the guy that is making the money from laying my tile has me questioning my entire life choices. And I think I'm just going to send my kids to tile laying school as soon as I possibly can. You know, is there a scenario where that labor market tightness actually bails out? Maybe there are fewer defaults, but man, as I say that, it feels like wishful thinking, but maybe it happens.
I think what you're seeing is an incredibly low level of labor force participation. And so there's only very low employment because it's as a percentage of those who are in the market to work. And so what you're then seeing is effectively the competition from the government to the job market. And so as you went through basically various forms of, you don't have to pay your rent, you don't have to make your mortgage payments, you're getting extra bennies, this, that, and the other way. People are like, well, why should I work if I'm going to make the same amount not working? All right. And so workforce participation is low, and that's an issue. Now, as Margaret Thatcher said, you know, socialism works until you run out of other people's money. And so ultimately, you know, we're at a $31 trillion national deficit and counting. And there's only so much free stuff that you can hand out before the dollars in which the free stuff is denominated need to be carried around in wheelbarrows.
I agree with you. I guess the pushback that I would say is, like, we've been hearing about this for so long and it hasn't happened. So might we be able to continue it? And again, as I say it out loud, I feel like it seems stupid to say, but it is the thought I've had, because for so long I've heard this.
Well, look, the question is, do you want to be the last guy to buy a $1,000 tulip?
Probably not. No, I would prefer not to be. I guess I'd rather be a lender on perhaps a tulip farm, assuming that the tulips have utility. I was looking at some of your other, this is not the best segue I've ever had, but I was looking at some of your other myths. Distress debt, do you mind talking about that a little bit?
Sure. That just goes to what we talked about with regard to labels in the investment product selling business, right? And so that happens to be one instance of the many distortions that are propagated by people trying to basically create the perception of there not being risk when there is risk in the things that they're selling. So in the case of quote-unquote distressed debt, as you can imagine, let's say a company has $10 of bank debt, it raises $5 of subordinate bonds, and then had $5 of equity. And let's say the performance of the company goes, you know, its cash flow goes down 25%. So its equity no longer has any value. And maybe its bank debt is trading at 80 and its bonds are trading at 30. There are people who buy that bond, right? And they call that distressed debt. But they're not really taking a debt risk, right? They're taking the equity, because after the cash flow goes down, the equity is not worth anything. And the guys who used to own the bonds are the equity now, right? And so you have two different, whereas the buyer of the debt in a restructuring will likely get a new piece of debt and or, you know, a very significant, you know, chunk of the equity as well, right? And is ultimately making much more of a credit-oriented risk. That in turn is a larger, you know, and an example of the larger phenomenon of this notion of, even is there a thing called debt or equity, right? All of this is just a continuum of risk from the very least amount of risk to the greatest amount of risk. And, you know, this notion that debt and equity are two completely different things that have nothing to do with each other is not really real. It's just a way to make things simple, although not necessarily is it representative of reality.
The interesting thing about, you know, this past decade or whatever that we've lived through, and it's always the case, but man, to be safe, to be higher in the capital stack and to avoid the risk has been such a poor return that so many people have been pushed away from that thinking, right? And as it always happens, it may be the exact wrong time to stop thinking about that. You know, this bounce in the equity markets has been interesting to watch. I don't trust it. Then there's the part of me that says the market's smarter than you. But then there's the part of me that says if you go down not betting on you, that's a pretty bad way to go down. So I don't know. This is, you know, it's an interesting game we all play. I was asking Josh about, you know, your firm and why you're able to find what you're able to find as far as opportunity sets. And something that he said is he thought it was a function of size and where you play in the market, right? You're big enough to source deals that not anyone can source, but you're small enough that you can be nimble and pick your spots. You know, one, I'd be curious whether or not you think that's an accurate description, and two, how do you think about scaling a product like that or a firm like that, or are you comfortable where you are in the ecosystem and just going to stay around there?
Think of it in these last several years as, you know, being a 6 foot tall man walking in a flood, right? And the things that as the water level rises and the water level is represented by bad risk reward, right? The larger opportunities are subsumed by the water. And if you're tall enough, you can stay above the floodwater in a series of things that, in the case of the last 14 years, tend to be smaller, that are that therefore not the subject of those who are really in the asset accumulation business versus the investment business. And so that ability to kind of operate underneath the competitive umbrella created by the large scale operators who have grown by, you know, leaps and bounds over the last many years has allowed us to not subject ourselves or our investors to the moral hazard that has been assumed by a lot of these folks. And so, interestingly, in this kind of market, as it gets worse, the opportunities really become like a barbell. So you have things that really implode and provide various forms of kind of opportunities because of the distortions and values and the volatility that arises. But you also have things that, on a risk-reward basis, maybe they're bigger than they have been in a while, or simpler than they have been in a while, because the people who otherwise would have occupied that space are otherwise dealing with issues that they've, you know, caused themselves by being participants in the kind of run-up, you know, to the sudden popping of the bubble. And so that means on the other side of the barbell, we're starting to come back to simpler and larger things that just have been poor risk reward for quite a long time that are now better. So as an example, in the wake of the crisis in 2010, we created an asset-based lender from scratch. And you know from your banking world experience that just means a pretty simple business of advancing against receivables, inventory, and a little bit of machinery on you know, kind of mid-sized, relatively uncompelling businesses. That was a really good thing to do in 2010, and we were able to efficiently finance that. And by 2016, it was much more difficult because a lot more money had come in. There was a lot more competition of all kinds. There was a lot more price taking. And we sold it. And we sold it at a multiple of book to another company. Well, about a year ago, it was looking good again, right? Because things got a little choppier. And we basically recreated the business we created in 2010 from zero and are now as busy as we were in 2011 doing these very simple things at twice the return that we were doing them at the time that we sold the business in 2016. It's the thin cycle.
That's interesting. Has that coincided with banks tightening their lending standards? Has that been part of what's created the opportunity for you, or is it just generally a scarcity in that market? Like where's the incremental opportunity coming from, do you think?
In a number of instances, these companies were provided or overbanked in some way, and their performance is diminished. And so when things start to get choppy, you know, banks are never big fans of financing something, even when the hard assets are available. And it's actually a result of the way bank regulation works, which is that, as an example, if you're a normal, quote unquote, normal bank, you can't just kind of proclaim yourself capable of doing asset-based lending and doing it. There's a whole Potemkin village you need to construct so that you can say, well, we know asset-based lending and here are the people who do it. And it's a whole production, right? Arduous and nonsensical. And so there's kind of natural barriers that stop banks from just kind of moving capital toward this, you know, when things get choppier, right? And so you have these people who were coming out of a bank who had issues servicing a normal bank loan and the bank saying, we don't want you anymore, right? And so then you're in this different world.
Okay, so is this the type of person that's maybe on like an accounts receivable and inventory borrowing base or whatever, but it's not like actually formally ABL, and then they have some credit deterioration, need to go to a formal ABL product, but another bank of that size doesn't have the ABL infrastructure, and then you walk in?
Yes.
That's smart, man. That's cool. It's got to be fun for you.
It's always interesting.
Yeah, well, to be able to exploit that opportunity, I mean, you're a value investor at heart, right? You're going where the opportunity is. You're just doing it in alternative spaces.
Absolutely. And again, if 1973 comes along, we'll buy stocks.
Yeah.
Right? But I wouldn't hold my breath for 1973, but we're indifferent to whether it comes.
You know, I have a couple of these conversations where I get off and I think I need to take a deep breath and kind of calm down. And this is going to be one of them. But, you know, I appreciate very much you being candid in how you see things. And it's really refreshing to have a conversation like this. All right, Dan. Well, you know, I don't want to let you out of here if you think we missed anything glaring, but if we did not, I want to say thanks for joining. So do you think that there's anything that we should add, or do you think we should wrap it there?
No, I think that's good. Works for me. I'm always happy to, you know, engage some more if it makes sense for you, but I think we covered the way we approach things, and you know, we'll see how the markets turn out.
Yeah, well, I agree, and I appreciate it. And should you ever want to come on, you got an open invite, just hit me up, and I'll say yes.
Sounds good.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.